Hi, and welcome to the Pay and Proxy podcast. I'm Meredith Irvine, and I'm a senior editor here at compensationstandards.com. Today, I'm happy to be joined by Cooley's Michael Bergman and Ali Murata. And they are here to discuss a big topic, some of the executive compensation related issues that companies are grappling with this year due to tariff uncertainty, greater macroeconomic uncertainty, and stock price volatility. So before we get into that very meaty topic, Allie and Michael, I wanted to ask if you could just briefly tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves and about your practices.
Sure. Thank you, Meredith. I'm Ali Murata, a partner in the Compensation and Benefits Practice Group at Cooley. I've practiced for just shy of 25 years, and my practice covers compensation and benefits related matters throughout the corporate life cycle, involving transactions, disclosure, structuring. So really the interplay between regulatory requirements and market compliance.
And thank you, Allie and Meredith. And this is Michael Bergman. I'm also a partner in Cooley's Compensation and Benefits practice. I've been practicing for approaching 35 years now with a focus on executive compensation and benefits, and really no area off limits, do public, private, large, small, transactional advisory, regardless of industry. So the matters we'll be talking about today are something that both Allie and I regularly advise on, whether with management, comp committees, or their other advisors.
Perfect. I thought we would kick off today's conversation kind of looking backward to earlier in 2025. I am curious if you saw your clients considering things like tariff uncertainty and market volatility when they were designing their pay programs for 2025 and actually target setting for their performance-based compensation for 2025. And if so, kind of how and whether that was factored into the design and the target setting this year.
So I'll jump in first. I did not. And I think it's tough. Obviously, no one's crystal ball was fully functional at the moment in a manner that would really even permit the structuring of compensation in connection with something that was a complete unknown. And I think even heading into, right, and I say a complete unknown, but even heading into Q1 of, for calendar year companies, while it was known, I think the impact was not something that could be fully appreciated at that time.
And I'll echo that actually, as Ali said, a complete unknown. In some sense, though, it was a known unknown that I do think companies learned from COVID to address third standard deviation events like this in a way that, wasn't peculiar to tariffs here, but raised the same type of considerations that third standard deviation stuff does. Second standard deviation stuff, say a regional war, just to make something up out of the blue. Those things happen all the time, and the comp decisions that people make need to be flexible enough, have elasticity in them, so that they accommodate foreseeable but unforeseen events.
And Michael, I think that that's a really good point because I think that one of the lessons that a number of companies did take away from COVID was to not overreact. And that while it's always great to be planning ahead, sometimes you're better served by waiting to see what happens if and when the dust settles.
Agree entirely. I think that the goal from an executive compensation standpoint, in my view, is to neither punish nor reward executives for things outside of their control. And if you have a knee-jerk reaction, I think you heighten the risk of doing that.
That all makes complete sense. One of the things that, people have brought up recently was a big focus during COVID as well is just conserving cash in periods of uncertainty. And I'm also curious if you saw companies kind of leaning more heavily on their equity programs so far this year, kind of with that cash conservation goal in mind.
So, yes, in a lot of respects, around the conservation of cash, I think that I have not yet seen certainly the extreme types of measures that we saw in COVID, where folks were literally swapping out cash compensation base salaries and the like in exchange for equity compensation. So I haven't seen a lot of that practice pop up. I have seen some of the other types, you know, a lot of discussions around types of awards and cadence of awards and really how and when to address awards that are no longer providing the types of incentives that were initially intended.
Yeah, again, I'll echo that. In my experience, companies regularly look to conserve cash when the world becomes unpredictable because there's no substitute for cash. If you don't have it, it can be tough to get. And that's for whatever reason, whether it be tariffs or just macroeconomic uncertainty, whatever that might be. And I do think that often means an increased reliance on equity because people do need to be paid, need to be given incentives. But that can present, you know, a two-sided squeeze because if that's the need for cash is coupled with a decline in stock price, all of a sudden you're left with very few levers to pull.
Well, Michael, you teed up my next question perfectly, which is how companies are really thinking about managing their burn rate and the dilutive impact of their equity programs now in the current environment.
I think that, you know, it's funny to hear Michael talk about the squeeze from both sides. I think about, right, like trying to plug a hole in the dam and you're going to at some point run out of fingers and appendages to put into places to stop the leaks. But I do think that it is a balance of there's the cash component of it. I've had a lot of conversations with clients, comp committees around the structuring of programs. And, you know, what do you do with underwater options? Some of those, right? Because it really is, and we're talking about the impact of tariffs, but really what's at play is the macroeconomic climate and the market volatility. And it puts a lot of pressure on, unlike COVID, where, you know, we had, it felt like a moment of, and I say a moment, of course, in retrospect, it feels like a moment, then the world was not even moving at all, but it was a moment of collective, everyone holding their breath. And then the market kind of took off on a tear. Here, it feels longer, more uncertain, and there isn't the, okay, now we're going to rely on equity to plug the gap of the cash because of the equity burn, right? So for some companies, there's been a lot of volatility in their stock price. Their stock price isn't where it was, and they've got options that are sitting out there underwater. So definitely a lot more renewed discussion of underwater equity, changing forms of equity awards, all of those discussions back on the table.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add there. The only thing I would mention is that companies need to be mindful of the collateral effects of share usage for public companies in particular, for example, or does that mean they're going to need to go out back to shareholders for a refresh of the share pool earlier than they wanted at what might prove to be an awkward time? And of course, the question is ultimately the same for private companies, although with maybe slightly different politics and dynamics, you need your shareholders to be on board. You know, those are all things that you need to have in mind.
Yep. I feel like companies go out to request new shares for stockholders every 3 years or so. So then when that gets squeezed now that that period is so tightened, it can feel like you're doing this all the time.
Yeah, and it becomes part of a story that you, again, particularly for public companies, but still for private companies as well, there needs to be a compelling, cogent narrative. How does this all fit together? Why is this okay?
Absolutely. So I do want to ask you both about 409A. I will say I'm a corporate attorney and a disclosure lawyer and not a tax attorney by any means, but I have read that there are some 409A traps for the unwary in periods like this. So I'd love it if the two of you could kind of speak to those for our audience.
Sure, I'll take a first stab at that. And the tentacles of 409 Cap A are just impressive. It infiltrates so many different areas, things that you wouldn't think about. I guess my view is, as a general proposition, 409 Cap A doesn't care about how much a company pays, but rather when it pays those amounts. And 409 Cap A generally makes it particularly difficult to change the timing of a promise payment after the payment schedule has been established. And so, among other things, 409 Cap A related here, companies need to be very careful about restructuring payment streams. And that applies regardless whether the program is exempt from or intended to be compliant with 409 Cap A. And note also that the timing of equity award vesting will often affect the timing of payment. And so those types of considerations apply. This is not simply a cash bonus type concern. And so, for example, changing a bonus plan to pay more but later seems like it's a simple fix, but that might not work, or at least it shouldn't be done in a cavalier manner without thinking through the 409 Cap A consequences, because 409 Cap A is complicated, far-reaching, and punitive. It's essential to get good advice before you've done something that may be difficult to unscramble.
I agree with all of that. And I think that, one of the common places where 409A does arise is this idea of, you've got someone who has earned an amount, we'll call it a bonus, and highest and best use of company cash at that moment in time may not be the payment of a bonus. And so where folks may think that what they're doing is a good thing for the company may actually turn out to have punitive tax consequences for the individual. So it's unfortunately, as Michael has just described it, right, the impressive tentacles of 409A, it really does touch everything and can do so in unanticipated ways.
So I want to look forward to, I think, what's going to be a key time given all these issues we've talked about already today, which is kind of post-fiscal year end when compensation committees are looking at corporate performance for 2025 and determining payouts under their performance-based compensation programs. And you usually see some discussion of, well, what if we use discretion? What if we made adjustments in times like this? But issues can accompany that. So I wondered if you could kind of speak to those issues and companies navigating that in early 2026.
Yes. So it's interesting because I think that in the absence of, right, the additional overlay that we have at play in the moment is, right, potential rulemaking and changes with the executive comp roundtable, reexamination of 402, all of that background, right, the rules in connection with investor engagement, right, a lot of change. It feels like a lot of change is on the horizon. And you add to it, I don't know what Michael's experience is. I always have one client every year who wants to be paying out something that has not been earned, whether it is a PSU, whether it is a bonus. So it is a conversation that I unfortunately have fairly frequently. Unclear to me, I have heard advice that one way to potentially address the issue now in connection with performance-based awards is to grant relative awards. Right, relative TSR, because presumably it can remove the noise of macroeconomic conditions, et cetera, and level the playing field. But that isn't always, you've got to have identified a peer group where that is in fact the case. And so that can be tough, certainly for a lot of the clients with whom Michael and I work, disruptors, et cetera, and technology companies. But in terms of year end, it is unclear whether, similar to what happened during COVID, there will be guidance coming from proxy advisory firms, which I feel like, and again, now we're right, like years past it, but I feel like that was a give us a good enough explanation. Let us know that you kind of acknowledge the rule and that you're deviating from it, and we'll give you a pass. There are, I think, some companies who fail to realize that that was a one-time special situation. And the other piece of it too is that I do think that outcome will vary greatly depending upon the particular makeup of the company in terms of its voting. We work with a lot of companies that have dual class structures. Not to say that those companies are completely ignoring outcomes and voting recommendations from proxy advisory firms, but they are less concerned. Directors, of course, are always concerned about getting negative recommendations. And what I will say is that it is a challenge in part because particularly with the PSU, for example, that gets paid when it has not been earned, that can have a 2-year impact on your disclosures versus a one-time hit. And that often is something that is overlooked when those decisions are made.
And not surprisingly, I'm just going to echo a few of the things that Ali just said. I think COVID gave us really a pretty good playbook for how to approach these matters. And I think it behooves companies, even if they're not public, to look at the proxy advisory firm guidance that came out around COVID. Not that that guidance was gospel, maybe not something that will govern what you do, but I do think it can help inform how you think about your own circumstances, put some discipline, some rigor around that analysis. My biggest takeaway is try to do the right thing for the right reasons. History generally is kind to you if you do that. Yeah, I think the only other thing I'll mention, we are focusing on post-fiscal year end, but it doesn't necessarily have to wait until post-fiscal year end. And if you wait to think about it until then, you may have fewer avenues, fewer choices about what you can do. Not that you want to do something prematurely, however.
That special COVID guidance is a great reminder. I remember how welcome that was at the time, but it had been so long, it was kind of out of my mind. So I appreciate that reminder to go back and look at that. My final question actually goes back to something, Ali, you brought up earlier in the podcast, which is, the issue with outstanding options that may have been granted a year ago, a few years ago, when the company's stock price was performing. And now they might be significantly underwater, and companies are asking, what can we do about this? So I wondered if you could speak, and I know this is a very big topic, but I wondered if you could speak a bit on kind of paths that might be available to companies in that situation and some of the pitfalls that accompany those.
So, it in part depends on the issue that the company is trying to solve for, which often is not just one thing. It's often multiple objectives, including conserving shares available for issuance under the pool, making sure that folks have the right incentives, all of these things, which are also the issues that are implicated in connection with, repricing certainly of underwater options, this perception of, hey, the stock price has gone down, and you're now just, what type of incentive is that? You're just rewarding the poor performance by re-upping at a lower price. There, of course, are any number of variants in terms of how one goes about dealing with underwater options from an exchange of some kind that at least has the benefit of telling a good story, right? That it wasn't a pain-free, hey, you're going to get another at-bat. And there isn't a price to be paid for it. So, there is, in those instances where there's an exchange, the stockholders are getting something back, presumably, if it is either a value for value exchange, right? Swapping out a number of underwater options for an RSU or even for a new option grant at the current fair market value. So, that is a version. There is also the overlay of, in connection with the repricing. A lot of companies will need to get stockholder approval in order to do it. I will note that if you have an equity plan, which is common for newly public companies to have an equity plan that permits a repricing without, like explicitly permits repricing without stockholder approval, which is the requirement for the ex from the exchange, of course, you don't have the requirement of the stockholder approval. However, you will get a negative say on pay recommendation. And, sometimes that is also coupled with 220 demands, things of that nature, because that's low-hanging fruit in that regard. So there are alternatives out there, and none of them are a free pass.
Yeah, really large in my mind always. I think there are three things you can do. You can do nothing, you can just grant more, or you can replace what you have. The last approach, the replacement, has regulatory issues that the first two don't have, and potential tender offer implication, ISO status, and for public companies, as Ali was mentioning, compliance with exchange rules on repricing. I think my view is don't be shy about being creative in design to meet the needs of your particular circumstances. There are things out there, you know, premium priced options. Is that something you might be able to use to dull the taste of it looking like there's another at bat being gratuitously given to folks? By no means am I saying premium priced options are the answer, just as an example of think outside the box as best you can so that you're using everything in the toolkit just to deal with your particular circumstances.
I think this is the year for thinking outside the box in all aspects.
Yes, agree.
Well, Allie and Michael, thank you so much for being here today and taking the time to speak with me. For everyone listening in, I wanted to note that the Cooley team had written a great memo on kind of navigating tariffs and economic volatility and uncertainty in the spring. And we will actually link to that memo and the podcast landing page as well. So please take a look at that when you have a moment. And thank you everyone for listening in. Michael and Allie, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.